listening to North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is Randall Rickman, your reader for Time Magazine, welcoming you back for the current edition of the magazine. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The date for this edition is September 30th, 2019. The cover story, The New American Addiction, How Juul Hooked Kids and Ignited a Public Health Crisis, by Jamie Ducharme. And Juul is spelled J-U-U-L. And to begin our session, we go right to the back of the magazine to make sure that we include this edition's interview feature. This week it's called Seven Questions. The interview subject is Renee Zellweger. Time says, the Oscar-winning actor on playing Judy Garland, how Bridget Jones holds up, and the public scrutiny of women. Question. You spent 2 years preparing for the film Judy. What stood out as the most important thing to capture about Judy Garland? Answer. What struck me was, despite the tragic circumstances and how they were portrayed on the public record, she never stopped hoping. She was a joyful person. She didn't strike me as a tragic figure at all. She seemed heroic in her determination to carry on and her belief that things would get better. Question. In the film, her fans feel they know her, but she doesn't appear to feel known by them. Is there a certain loneliness that comes with fame? Answer. I'm sure it's different for everybody. I suppose it depends on how much of your public persona and professional responsibilities consume your time versus how much time you spend focusing on the person behind the public persona. Question. Is it different preparing to play a real person? Answer. Absolutely, because there are parameters that are the historical record. But having an experience with that myself, and being the subject of certain reporting, I try to be judicious in looking at it and consider the source, and remember that whatever is out there is always through the lens of someone's personal agenda or their own damage. Question. She once called herself the Queen of the Comeback. Answer. She can't go to the bathroom without them calling it a comeback. Question. There's a narrative around the movie that it's a comeback for you, just a few years after you returned from a six-year hiatus from acting. How does that word sit with you? Answer. I don't think about that kind of stuff. However, people interpret things. It's none of my business. I don't read things. I'm not on social media. Question. Your break coincided with an age when many women find that juicy roles start to dry up. Do you feel like you skipped that period? Answer. Maybe. Or maybe the industry changed and there are more outlets for material. There will be an audience for stories about women of every age if someone creates them. There's always been an audience for different kinds of material. It's just limited in terms of what the business model seemed to allow. So as that's changing, the range of stories is expanding. Escape at Dannemora and Patricia Arquette out there doing her thing. Patricia Clarkson doing her thing. Julia Roberts doing her thing. The list goes on. Question. I rewatched Bridget Jones's Diary recently. It's different watching Bridget's flirtations with her boss, Daniel Cleaver, parenthetically Hugh Grant, in the Me Too era. Is it fair to judge past movies through the lens of today? Answer. I can't remember how much of it they were trying to conceal because it was taboo. It wasn't something they were trying to advertise. Maybe there are just different consequences hanging in the balance in 2019. Question. In 2016, you wrote an op-ed criticizing tabloid scrutiny of women's bodies, including your own. Has anything changed since then? Answer. That's a big question. I think there's a consciousness about it that might be a little bit different. What do you think? Final question. We have a long way to go. Answer. Maybe. But there are institutionalized social behaviors that are reinforced through generations. So inevitably, it's going to change if you have women raise their children with an expectation that they be treated differently. As we go forward and we make certain realizations about the way we conduct ourselves in society, then the change comes. But I expect that it will take a minute. That was the entire interview with Renee Zellweger, Oscar-winning actor, now playing Judy Garland. Interview conducted for Time by Eliza Berman. While we're in the back of the magazine, there's another feature we want to be sure to include in this reading, and that is movies, where the headline is A Downton Abbey That Fills the Big Screen. Review by Stephanie Zekerik. She writes, as a person who has seen barely a flicker of Downton Abbey on television, I can't predict whether the movie spinoff, directed by Michael Angler and written by the show's creator, Julian Fellowes, will be everything longtime fans have hoped for. But as a one-off, it's a featherweight delight, like the prettiest pink and white cake on the tea tray. It's 1927, and the denizens of Downton are in a tizzy. King George and Queen Mary are planning a trip through Yorkshire, and they'll be stopping off for one night at the estate. They're bringing all their own servants, which upsets the Downton staff, presided over by the ever-sensible Mr. Carson and Mrs. Hughes, parenthetically Jim Carter and Phyllis Logan. But the impending visit sets off china-rattling reverberations throughout the rest of the household, too. Lady Mary Talbot, parenthetically Michelle Dockery, now in charge of managing the house, worries that everything will go wrong, and Lady Edith, parenthetically Laura Carmichael, now happily married, has her own unexpected development to contend with. Meanwhile, peppery Dowager Countess Violet Crawley, parenthetically Maggie Smith, squares off against a long-lost and equally stubborn relative, Lady Bagshaw, Imelda Staunton. Sweet Desiree Isabel Gray, Penelope Wilton, ends up running interference. Intrigue, romantic travails, and plain old stress rule the day, both upstairs and downstairs. And Fellows and Engler keep all the gears running smoothly. But come now, you really came here to find out about the gowns and the jewelry, didn't you? Liquid velvet day dresses in period-perfect shades of burnt coral and tobacco, ropes of Venetian glass beads in undersea fantasia colors, a fate-worthy deep blue fortune-y pleated evening gown. The costumes by Anna Robbins are spectacular. You wouldn't really want to be a member of the aristocracy. It's a lot of bother. But gazing at these lives from afar is a gentle pleasure and one you shouldn't feel guilty about. Entire review of Downton Abbey by Stephanie Zekerik. We now go to the front of the magazine, and we come to the regular opening feature, and that is, for the record, the one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a line drawing, a headline in bold, or a quotation, or a combination. In the upper right corner of the page is the story illustrated by the monetary statistic $11 billion. Caption explains, settlement that California utility PG&E has agreed to pay for its role in the 2017 Wine Country fires and the 2018 Camp fire, which killed 85 people. In red, $11 billion. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Beto O'Rourke, presidential candidate, at the third Democratic debate on September 12th, describing his plan to force buybacks of assault-style weapons. And the quotation from presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, quote, "Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47, unquote. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Greta Thunberg, Swedish climate change activist, 16, to Democratic senators who invited her to a forum in Washington on September 17th. And the quotation from Greta Thunberg, 16, quote, "I know you're trying, but just not hard enough. Sorry," unquote. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the new pronouns they, comma, and themselves. They and themselves. Caption explains, pronouns used to refer to a single person whose gender identity is non-binary. And the caption to the caption says, among 533 new entries, Merriam-Webster added to its dictionary on September 17th, they and themselves. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the calendar amount in red, 14 days. Caption explains, jail sentence handed down to Felicity Huffman on September 13th. The actor admitted in May to paying $15,000 in 2017 to have her older daughter's SAT answers doctored. In red, 14 days. Above that, at the left middle margin of the page, again in red, another numerical amount, which is 190 million. Caption explains, distance in miles to a newly discovered comet at its closest approach to Earth. Scientists believe it may be the second interstellar object ever observed in our solar system. 190 million miles. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Boris Johnson, UK Prime Minister, in a Mail on Sunday interview published on September 14th on his determination to take his country out of the EU next month. And the quotation from UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, quote, "The madder Hulk gets, the stronger Hulk gets," unquote. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Sayed Molai, Iranian judo champion, in an AP interview published September 16th, after refusing a government directive to throw a match. And the quotation from Iranian judo champion Sayed Molai, quote, "I did this for my human soul, for myself. I wanted to practice and compete with freedom, with peace of mind," unquote. Also, the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, stressed out sheep. After a ewe was spotted in Chicago, Police tracked her down under Goodweek, chilled out goats. A Florida farm attempted to break the world record for the largest goat yoga class. And that was the entire content of the For the Record page. Moving ahead now, and the major beginning section of the magazine is the brief. And a subsection here is the bulletin, where the headline is, with the far right out of power in Italy, the EU edges toward migration reform, by Billy Perigo. After 6 days at sea on September 14th, the Ocean Viking sailed into port carrying 82 asylum seekers. It was the first rescue ship to dock in Italy since Matteo Salvini, one of Europe's most fervent anti-immigrant politicians, lost his job as interior minister. He had shut Italian ports to rescue ships like the Ocean Viking, but his coalition government collapsed in August over the direction of migration policy. On September 10th, a new coalition took office without his far-right League party. Quote, "This is the end of Salvini's propaganda," unquote, a new minister tweeted. Billy Perigo goes on to list three subject items. First item, deadly passage. After becoming interior minister in June 2018, Salvini threatened fines of up to 1 million euros and human smuggling charges for captains who defied his migrant entry ban. It had the desired effect. Arrivals have fallen to around 6,200 so far in 2019, down from over 20,000 in the same period in 2018. But it also made the journey deadlier. For every 10 migrants who arrived in Italy by sea this year, one has died en route. That's roughly double the 2018 rate. Second item, sea change. With Salvini gone, reformers in Italy and Brussels see a chance to act. Their focus is on the EU's so-called Dublin regulation, which forces migrants to apply for asylum in the first member state where they set foot. Since 2014, more than 600,000 have arrived in Italy. Moderates say the burden on Italy helped Salvini's anti-migrant populism to flourish. Quote, "The Dublin regulation must be modified," unquote, said Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte on September 10th. Third and final item, shared burden. For now, more piecemeal reforms may have to do. As the Ocean Viking prepared to dock, France, Germany, and other EU countries agreed to share in relocating those on board. But a long-term solution has yet to be agreed upon. On September 23rd, EU interior ministers are meeting to decide how to deal with future ships. Germany said it was ready to accept 25% of all arrivals. But the window to act might not last long. Salvini is still hugely popular in Italy and is the favorite to win an election if the new coalition is unable to govern. Entire item by Billy Perigo. On this page is the sidebar feature, News Ticker. It's a collection of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, forest fires spread across Indonesia. Forest fires burned across the islands of Borneo and Sumatra on September 17th, disrupting flights and choking nearby cities with air pollution. The fires, the worst in years thanks to a long dry season, threatened the habitats of endangered species, including orangutans. Middle item, Trump repeals clean water regulation. The Trump administration announced the repeal of the Waters of the United States rule on September 12th, the Obama-era rule, the latest of many environmental regulations reversed or weakened under Trump, limited the use of environmentally damaging chemicals near bodies of water like wetlands and streams. Bottom item. Snowden. I want to come home. Edward Snowden, who has been living in Russia since revealing details of NSA surveillance in 2013, said he wants to come back to the U.S., but doesn't believe he'd get a fair trial. On September 17th, the U.S. filed suit against the whistleblower, saying his new memoir violates non-disclosure agreements. And moving ahead, we are now at the milestones page. Under Died, Cokie Roberts, The Voice of D.C. Observance by Walter Isaacson. Time says Isaacson, a former editor of Time, was an intern at the office of Majority Leader Hale Boggs, Roberts' father. Walter Isaacson writes, growing up in both Washington, D.C. and New Orleans, Cokie Roberts, who died on September 17th at 75, developed a love for politics, a wry humor about its lovable rogues, and a reverence for its institutions. She was born Mary Martha Corrine Morrison Claiborne Boggs. Her last three names connected her to political dynasties that included the first governor of Louisiana and New Orleans mayor, and her father, who was U.S. House Majority Leader when she was young. Quote, because I spent time in the Capitol, and particularly in the House of Representatives, I became deeply committed to the American system, unquote, she said. Quote, and as close up and as personally as I saw it, and saw all of the flaws, I understood all of the glories in it, unquote. With her bourbon-cured drawl and common-sense insights, she was a voice of reason in political journalism for NPR and ABC. An inspiring historical storyteller, she wrote engaging books chronicling the colorful women who helped shape America. Most important, with her ready laugh and way of saying, darling, which she learned from her mother, who also served in Congress, she was simply a good person, filled with love for those around her and for the institutions of her country. Cokie Roberts, observance by Walter Isaacson. This item is accompanied by a half-length, full-collar shot of Cokie Roberts wearing a light blue suit. Under Died, Rick Ocasek, Rock Original. Observance by Andrew R. Chow. Rick Ocasek didn't look or sound much like the classic conception of a rock star. He was spindly, with a lilting gait and deep-set eyes. He sang in a plaintive, reedy voice. But the songwriter and lead singer of The Cars, who died on September 15th at 75, didn't particularly care for conventions. Indeed, he spent his career tweaking and then reinventing them. The Cars, formed by Ocasek and Benjamin Orr, broke out of Boston's music scene in the late 1970s and helped define a movement that would become known as New Wave, integrating rock's pugnacious past with its synthetic future. Songs like Just What I Needed, Drive, and Let's Go united fans of punk, college rock, and mainstream pop alike. As the band receded from prominence, Ocasek shepherded a new generation of rockers to the fore, by producing artists like Weezer, Not a Surf, and No Doubt. In 2018, he and the Cars were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Ocasek might not have been what was expected, but time and time again, he was just what was needed. Andrew Archell, writing about Rick Ocasek. That item is also accompanied by a full-length color photograph. Caption says, Ocasek, seen here around 1980, also dabbled in painting, poetry, and comedy. Under died Juanita Abernathy, activist's activist. Observance by Reverend Al Sharpton. Time says Sharpton is host of Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. He writes, Juanita Abernathy used to say she'd known me since I was a little boy, before I got, quote, controversial and famous, unquote. I joined the Southern Christian Leadership Conference when I was 13, shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Ralph Abernathy succeeded him as president, and Juanita, who died on September 12th at 88, was its first lady. When Dr. King was new in Montgomery, Alabama, Juanita had become the support system for the King family. When Dr. King's house was bombed after the bus boycott, the Abernathy house was bombed too. Juanita was the backbone of that family, and that family was the backbone of the civil rights movement. She was at the marches. She was at the rallies. She spoke to women in the churches about what needed to be done. Unlike her husband and Dr. King, she didn't get the credit she deserved, but she was a pivotal part of the movement. Anti-observance by Al Sharpton, Juanita Abernathy. This item also is accompanied by a half-length black-and-white photograph of Juanita Abernathy. She is sitting in front of a church organ. That was the entire content of this edition's Milestones page, three items. On the opposite page, the regular feature, Good Question, has the headline, What will Purdue's bankruptcy filing do to opioid lawsuits? By Sonia Mansour. When Purdue Pharma announced on September 15th that it had reached a possible settlement in a major federal case involving America's opioid crisis, the embattled pharmaceutical shared other news, too, that as part of the proposed deal, it had filed for bankruptcy. But those announcements are unlikely to spell a resolution for the lawsuits facing Purdue, which is accused of contributing to the public health crisis by using deceptive marketing practices to promote its prescription painkiller, OxyContin. Purdue has been sued in various courts over OxyContin, but central to the new developments is one major federal case before an Ohio judge involving some 1,600 consolidated lawsuits from across the country. The company, which did not admit to any wrongdoing, said in a statement that it had reached the possible settlement with members of the plaintiff's counsel, in addition to more than 20 state attorneys general. The deal remains tentative and controversial, but on September 16th, the judge overseeing the case removed Purdue as a defendant. However, as attorneys general from at least 24 states and the District of Columbia have already rejected Purdue's deal, according to the Associated Press, they say the bankruptcy filing is a way for the Sackler family, which owns the company and has agreed to pay, quote, a minimum of $3 billion, unquote, under the proposed settlement, as a way for the Sackler family to evade financial responsibility. It should also prevent new lawsuits. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey said at a press conference on September 16th that the deal, quote, is not going to require the Sacklers to pay back any of the profits they took out of Purdue from sales of OxyContin over the last many years. Not a dime, unquote. In the meantime, the crisis at the heart of the cases continues. From 1999 to 2017, almost 400,000 people died from an overdose involving an opioid. There is more that we eliminated in this article by Sonia Mansour in the interest of getting more material as much as possible into this reading. And moving ahead, we are now at the risk report, where the headline is Mr. Johnson Goes to Brussels by Ian Bremmer. Newly elected British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stormed into 10 Downing Street this past summer, vowing to do the impossible, secure a better deal from Brussels than the one offered to his predecessor, Theresa May. Johnson threatened to pull the UK out of the EU on October 31st, should that deal not materialize. 2 months later, Johnson's impossible promise remains very challenging. Not only have the Europeans refused to reopen negotiations, but Johnson's move to sidestep the British Parliament by suspending it for 5 weeks triggered parliamentary mutiny. Johnson and his Conservative Party lost their working majority in the House of Commons, and a cross-party alliance of MPs, including a number of high-profile Tories, banded together to pass legislation preventing Johnson from pulling the UK out of the EU absent a deal. Johnson then demanded a general election to secure himself a mandate to move forward with his do-or-die negotiation strategy with Brussels. But British parliamentarians refused that as well until Johnson obtained either an extension or a deal from Brussels. Now Johnson has gone to the continent in search of a deal and political salvation. The sticking point, as former Prime Minister May learned, is what happens between Northern Ireland, part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, part of the EU. The Good Friday Agreement that helped end much of the sectarian violence in Northern Ireland did away with any hard border between the two sides, which worked fine so long as both remained part of the EU. Once the UK opted to leave the EU, Brussels insisted that Northern Ireland remain part of the European Customs Union as a backstop until a system could be devised to keep the border open while protecting the integrity of the EU marketplace. This was a non-starter for May, and more important, for the Democratic Unionist Party, parenthetically DUP, which was propping up her government. For them, none of the constituent elements of the UK, England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, could be subject to a different customs framework from the rest of the kingdom, lest it jeopardize the unity of the country. In the only real significant concession Brussels made to the British, it allowed the backstop to apply to the whole of the UK rather than just Northern Ireland until alternative arrangements could be found. Hardline Brexiteers, Johnson among them, didn't consider this a concession at all and demanded that the backstop be scrapped entirely. Europeans refused to budge and told Johnson to come up with a workable alternative. They're still waiting. And there is more to this item as all as well, but we move forward to get more material in. Sharing this page is a sidebar. Under the general heading Quick Talk, a feature, the headline is What People Want in a Mate by Belinda Luscombe. What do humans really want in a long-term partner? And how much of what we want is influenced by culture as opposed to innate? In a new report out of Swansea University in the UK, researchers got 2,700 college students from five countries, three from Western cultures and two from Eastern cultures, to progressively narrow down which characteristics were most important to them in a lifetime mate. Quote, for men and women from both cultures, the most important trait, hands down, was kindness, unquote, says lead author and psychology lecturer Andrew G. Thomas. After that, there was a split by gender. Across cultures, men said they value physical attractiveness, while women prioritized financial stability. But there were international nuances, too. Western partners tended to desire humor more than those from Eastern cultures, who leaned a little more toward religiosity and chastity. Western women also valued mates who wanted to have kids. Thomas attributes this to a higher use of contraceptives in their countries, which makes childbearing more a matter of choice. That was the entire article by Belinda Luscombe. Moving ahead, we are now at the cover story. The general heading is Society, and the headline is Inside the Dangerous Rise of Juul. And once again, Juul is a brand name spelled J-U-U-L. How a mostly unregulated company disrupted big tobacco and hooked millions of Americans on a new vice. Article by Jamie Ducharme. In the Sheets household, back-to-school anxiety reached new heights this fall. Jamie Sheets' 15-year-old son, Devon, who has severe asthma, kicked a brutal vaping habit over the summer with help from a nicotine patch. But as soon as school started and he was once again around kids vaping, his habit returned. On September 12th, Devon vaped at school and immediately began sweating and vomiting. Though Sheets, who lives in Sellersville, Pennsylvania, says her son is now fine, she can't shake thoughts of kids who have been hospitalized or died after using e-cigarettes. Quote, vaping scares me more than smoking because they don't know what's really in it, unquote, she says. To a remarkable degree, a single company is front and center in one of the biggest public health crises facing the country, the sharp rise in vaping among teenagers and young adults. In 2018, 30% of the nation's 12th graders reported vaping nicotine at least once in the past year, according to a January 2019 study sponsored by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. The study said the increase in vaping last year was, quote, the largest ever recorded for any substance in the 44 years, unquote, that it has tracked adolescent drug use. Though Juul is not the only e-cigarette for sale in the U.S., it is largely blamed for the vaping explosion and controls about 50% of the market, putting a sharp focus on the company. On September 9th, the Food and Drug Administration sent Juul a warning letter accusing the company of violating federal regulations by promoting its e-cigarettes as a safer option than traditional cigarettes, and threatening the company with fines and product seizures if it continued. 2 days later, the Trump administration said it planned to pull from the market flavored e-cigarettes such as Juul's mango, cream, and mint pods. In the Oval Office, with First Lady Melania at his side, President Trump said, quote, "We can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected," unquote. He added that the First Lady, who tweeted a warning about vaping, feels, quote, "very, very strongly," unquote, about the issue because of their teenage son, Barron. Just days later, New York banned most flavored e-cigarettes statewide, following in the footsteps of Michigan and Juul's home city of San Francisco, whose mayor signed an ordinance effectively banning e-cigarettes. The recent moves were prompted by U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports of almost 400 serious lung illnesses and 6 deaths it linked to vaping, which a congressional committee is also investigating. While Juul products have not been implicated in the deaths, the CDC in September advised Americans to, quote, "consider not using e-cigarette products," unquote, while its investigation is ongoing. The American Lung Association went further, saying in a statement that, quote, "no one should use e-cigarettes or any other tobacco product," unquote. Huge international markets, including India and China, are also restricting the sale of e-cigarettes. Given the possible risks to the nation's youth, Juul's rapid growth has been accompanied by remarkably little oversight or regulation. I'll repeat that sentence for clarity. Given the possible risks to the nation's youth, Juul's rapid growth has been accompanied by remarkably little oversight or regulation. And while there is a legitimate debate over whether e-cigarettes are safer for adult smokers than traditional cigarettes, and whether they can help addicts quit smoking, critics argue that Juul has assiduously followed Big Tobacco's playbook, aggressively marketing to youth and making implied health claims a central pillar of its business plan. Juul maintains that it is not Big Tobacco 2.0. In 8 months, unless e-cigarette companies can prove to the FDA that vaping is, quote, "appropriate for the protection of public health," unquote, the products could be pulled from the market. That would curtail youth use, but some fear it could also cut off adult smokers' access to a potentially beneficial product. Juul, which was valued at $38 billion by its investors before the Trump administration crackdown, is now facing what CEO Kevin Burns in July called, unquote, "existential," unquote, threat due to rising levels of youth use. Lobbyists, staff scientists, and PR experts are working feverishly to respond to the growing public outrage. Burns told Time in July, quote, "we've got to respond. I would love it to be less dynamic here than it is because it's not easy on the organization. But I think the organization understands that we're at the forefront here and it's going to be volatile," unquote. Juul says that it does not make health claims and that it has never marketed to youth. The company has taken recent steps to make it harder for young people to illegally buy its products, both online and in stores. Nobody hates Jewel more than parents, many of whom are watching their children fall prey to the, quote, epidemic on speed, unquote, that is Jeweling, as New York parent Erin Mills puts it. She blames her son's 2-year addiction to Jewels for causing his grades and social life to plummet, while she says she and her husband watched helplessly. It's, quote, like this tsunami, unquote, she says, quote, and I see my child going under, unquote. To help parents like Mills, New York City mothers Meredith Berkman, Dorian Furman, and Dina Alessi formed the advocacy group Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes in 2018. It has grown to about a dozen chapters across the country. I'll repeat that for clarity. Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes. Berkman argued at a congressional hearing in July that today's kids are becoming, quote, an entire generation of nicotine addicts, unquote, and, quote, human guinea pigs for the Juul experiment, unquote. Filmmaker Judd Apatow made his opinion clear on September 9th, tweeting, quote, Juul is some evil, unrepeatable. Keep your kids away from it. It's a scam to get you addicted, unquote. Hundreds of U.S. school districts have installed electronic vape detectors in their bathrooms, or, quote, Juul rooms, unquote. And one in Alabama went further, removing some bathroom doors to make it harder to vape in secret. But the product's design has complicated that task. Juul's $35 sleek slate gray and silver e-cigs are often compared to flash drives or iPhones, in sharp contrast to the clunky tank-style devices that preceded them. They're small enough to fit in the palm of your hand and subtly vaporize pods of liquid containing nicotine, flavorings, and other chemicals. A four-pack costs $16, and each 200-puff pod delivers as much nicotine as a pack of 20 cigarettes. Halving, that is, cutting in half, halving cigarette smoking rates since the 1960s, remains one of America's biggest public health triumphs, even though smoking, which is responsible for more than 480,000 deaths annually, remains the leading cause of preventable death in the U.S. Teen cigarette smoking, too, had seen historic declines in recent years. Now that hard-won success may be in peril. There is much more to this cover article, but we'll go to another feature article to make sure that we get as much diverse material into this reading. The feature we're also including is in the general heading World. The headline here is Eye of the Storm. After a turbulent year, Emmanuel Macron still dreams of a new France. Article by Vivian Walt, Dateline, Paris. It's a bright early September day inside France's presidential Élysée Palace, and President Emmanuel Macron is reflecting on the grueling 12 months just passed, with the so-called Yellow Vests protesters raging across the country, many aiming their fury at him. That was surely enough to rattle any leader. Yet Macron, leaning forward on his leather couch, offers another view. Quote, in a certain way, the gilets jaunes, yellow vests, were very good for me, unquote, he says. The afternoon shadows lengthened on the lawn outside. Quote, because it reminded me who I should be, unquote. The question of who Emmanuel Macron should be has occupied the French and many around the world in the 3 years since the then economy minister launched a grassroots uprising of his own. The movement would deliver him the presidency in May 2017 and smash a political order that had lasted for half a century. Macron, first and foremost, saw himself as a reformer, throwing himself into dismantling rules that he believed had long strangled France's economic prospects. He and his La République en Marche, La République en Marche party, parenthetically LREM, La République en Marche, scrapped a wealth tax levied on France's richest residents, trimmed the country's labyrinthine labor regulations, and made it less costly for companies to hire and fire. But Macron also saw himself as a global leader. In the 2 years since his victory, the president, just 41, has inserted himself into every international crisis, striding into the vacuum left by the weakened German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the Brexit distracted UK, and a U.S. president in retreat from the role of leader of the West. In a fractious European Union, Macron has quietly worked to shape the agenda on pivotal issues like the environment, defense, trade, and data privacy. Time called him the, quote, next leader of Europe, unquote, on its November 2017 cover, adding a caveat, quote, if only he can lead France, unquote. Over the past year, he has struggled to answer the questions raised by the second part of that headline. As the president bestrode the world stage and dreamed up far-reaching reforms to transform France, many of his constituents grew restless. From the start, some in France regarded Macron as an arrogant know-it-all, whose past as an investment banker suggested membership in a hated elite. Macron did little to assuage that opinion in office. Scrapping the wealth tax saved the richest French millions. He was quickly nicknamed the Président des Riches, parenthetically, the President of the Rich. Then in November 2018, Macron announced an increased fuel tax to help pay for his ambitious green energy rollout. Thousands snapped in anger, providing the raw ingredients for the Yellow Vest movement to detonate full force. Unlike the other popular revolts that have periodically rocked France in past decades, this one was not organized by any labor or student organization. It mushroomed leaderless on Facebook, then ricocheted across the country, with protesters battling police, smashing storefronts, and burning barricades for months on end. In December, Macron's popularity had shrunk to about 23%, forcing him to make a chastened retreat from his fuel tax and commit an additional $11 billion to social benefits. With his ambitious reform agenda on the line, Macron decided to launch a months-long listening tour through the heartland, what he called a grand débat, or big debate. I'll attempt that again, a grand débat. It grew out of what he learned from the street violence, he says, that he was too disconnected from the average French person. Quote, my challenge is to listen to people much better than I did at the very beginning, unquote. He says, no. His town hall meetings across France seem to have rescued his presidency. Macron's popularity now sits between 34% and 43%, up nearly 10 points from January. although the Yellow Vests have resumed their Saturday street battles with police after a summer break, their numbers have shrunk. The supreme confidence is still there, but in a shift from Time's last meeting with Macron in 2017, he was relaxed and informal. In his short sleeves, he leaned back and reflected at length on his tumultuous time in office and what might lie ahead. He hardly looked like a man who had weathered one of the most violent years in modern France, with Yellow Vest protesters hurling vitriol at him. Yet friends say he suffered behind the scenes. Quote, "There have been moments, very rough, especially on a personal standpoint," unquote, says Ismaël Emelian, a longtime advisor of Macron's, who left the Élysée in February. Quote, "He always knew that since we were transforming the country, it would come with some costs," unquote. And we are just about out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. We certainly appreciate your presence with us and your patience with your reader as you struggle through some of the other languages aside from English. Well, some English, too. You have been listening to North Carolina Reading Service. I'm your Time reader, Randall Rickman. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available at a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, 919-832-5138. We're thrilled to have you with us every time for Time. Please make time for us again.